CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 160 with Dr. Jody Lux. Changing your job mid-career. And then how do you get started with clinical trials? Let's learn together. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today, I've got a very special guest. I got my dear friend, Dr. Jody Lux, who's done, 100 clinical trials. He made a big move from New York, which I thought you'd never leave, to Florida. And I got so many questions to ask you.
Let's hear it. I'm honored to be here. It's a pleasure to enjoy this podcast with you, Uday, and I'm looking forward to it.
So I always figured you were like a perpetual New York guy, right? You did med school at Einstein. You did your residency in New York. You left a little bit to go to Philly for Wills for your Cornea Fellowship. But then you came back to New York. You were in Long Island like forever.
Yeah, I have to say, I grew up in Englewood, New Jersey, which is right outside of New York City, literally just over the GW Bridge. So I consider myself a New Yorker growing up. Always, spent time in Manhattan. And then I did all of my education in and around, the New York and Philadelphia areas. So medical school is up at Albert Einstein in the Bronx. Gotta love the Bronx.
Great training there. Montefiore, that's a great hospital train, right?
Yeah, phenomenal training. Worked hard. Did my internship in Manhattan at Mount Sinai Medical Center. No slouch of an internship. Worked hard, and then went to Long Island Jewish for my residency. Went to Wills for fellowship. So New York and Philadelphia is where I've been. And then I practiced on Long Island, like you said, for 22 years until I made the move to Florida.
So what made you make the big move? That's quite a move.
Yeah, it was quite a move. And so it's an interesting story. So, I'm cooking along. I'm in a very nice practice on the South Shore of Long Island for, 20 plus years. There's five of us that are owners in the practice. We had some part-time docs come and go, but for the most part, there's five of us. I joined the practice on a handshake right out of fellowship.
Wow.
A great bunch of guys. And it was a great practice, one of the busiest on the South Shore of Long Island, and very comfortable to be in. We were growing. I was the only cornea guy there. And then I started the research department there. We can talk about how that happened in a moment. But started research there. So we got a very big research department going with lots of clinical trials, as you said. Was building the surgical practice. And, now all of a sudden, the blink of the eye as these things go, all of a sudden I'm in my, my 50s.
Right. Happens to the best of us.
Right. All of a sudden, you wake up one day and all of a sudden, you're 52, 53 years old. And so at that point in my life, I had gotten to a point where I was just kind of looking for something else. I wanted to transition the practice into my practice personally, into more of a surgical practice rather than a mix of cornea and general ophthalmology and surgery, which I was doing and I loved for 20 plus years. But I really wanted to evolve to be more of a primary cataract and refractive surgeon. And, Long Island is a crowded place. And, the area where I was situated was crowded with ophthalmologists. And it didn't quite jive to make my personal practice that way with the practice I was with. And I love those guys, nothing against them. It was just the way it was. And then slowly everyone around me started migrating to Florida. My wife's parents went to Florida. My older son went to Florida. The woman he married, my daughter-in-law now, ex-daughter-in-law, was from, her parents were from down there, so she wanted to be there. So they migrated down there. My ex-wife and my two older children all went to Florida. Actually, my older son went to University of Central Florida in Orlando, and my ex-wife and my older daughter then migrated down. So now all of my kids, kids were in Florida, okay? And my beautiful current wife and our daughter were still here in New York, and I'm getting a little disenchanted with the practice. I wanted to grow and finish my career as a cataract and refractive surgeon primarily. Sure. And so I started putting out feelers around, and I'm part of the Cedars Group, one of the founders of the Cedars Group. And, like you, I have a big network of friends around the country. So I just kind of put out some feelers like, hey, if anyone's looking for someone, I might be interested in making a move. and not really expecting anything. And I was doing very well in my practice, you know, certainly nothing to complain about from that point of view. But then someone I'm sure you know very well, Quentin Allen, gives me a call, you know, Quentin, and he's like, you know, hey, Jody, you know, I heard you might be interested in maybe coming to Florida. I wanted to go someplace warm. I was really tired of the cold in New York. He's like, I got a spot. You know, you may be interested. I'm like, okay, I'll talk to anybody. So I flew down to Florida and saw, you know, the beautiful setup that he has down here in, at Florida Vision Institute. And I interviewed down there, which went very well. And of course, for the interview, they set me up in the office on in West Palm Beach on the fifth floor of a beautiful glass building overlooking the Intercoastal. So I'm sitting there in the conference room with the palm trees out the window, the view of the Intercoastal, and I'm like, yeah, this could be my view every day. You know, very enticing. But it was a great practice. And so then my wife and I had a conversation, and God bless her. She goes, look, you're, you know, I was 8 years ago. So I was 52 years old. Okay. 52 years old. She goes, you're at the top of your game. You know, very well known, as you know. I was, you know, lots of clinical trials. People know who I am. I'm lecturing all around, industry and otherwise. And she's like, you're at the top of the game. She's like, if we wait on this and we wait until our younger daughter goes to college, which is going to be a few years from now, she's like, by that time, you're going to be in your 60s. Like, who's going to really want you to join your practice and so forth? So if we're going to make a move, now's the time. And we had just bought our dream house on Long Island. She was like, we hate to part with it, but she's like, this is a great opportunity. We'd love to finish out in Florida. You'll be near your kids. I'll be my, you know, my parents. And lo and behold, we just decided to take a leap of faith and we made the move. And thank goodness, you know, and I knew Quentin and I knew that he wouldn't steer me wrong. And it turned out to be an excellent move. Thrilled to be down here, and now I've built in this practice a primarily a cataract and refractive practice. We're settled in down there. We just built a house. My daughter's loving school down here, and I'm near my all of my kids, and now I've got two grandkids and a third on the way that I wouldn't be able to see as often if I was up in New York. So it just worked out so well, and it was all a leap of faith. And I give all the credit to my wife, who basically said, if you're going to do it, now's the time. And I'm behind you. So there's a long-winded answer for you.
Well, you know, I love that you got to emphasize the points to the young ophthalmologist that first you have to evolve your career. And there's
Yeah.
certain times you just got to change gears. You got to pivot in your career. That's
Absolutely.
helpful.
Absolutely. And honestly, I couldn't have been at a point where I would have been able to make this move if it wasn't, if I didn't have the, you know, the 20 years that I had built on at this practice. It was a great practice. It afforded me the opportunity to have a wonderful career, to build a research department, and it allowed me the latitude to do the lecturing and the networking that I did to get myself, you know, involved in not only the ophthalmic community, but also the industry community, our industry partners, and to get involved with them. And all of that was the foundation which allowed me the ability to be, you know, someone that someone would want to bring into their practice.
Yeah, I think it's so important to be able to do exactly that, pivot, change gears,
Right.
do something a little bit different. And then again, yeah, timing's kind of everything. You can't,
Right.
there's a right time, and if you wait too long, that moment just passes you by.
Exactly. And thank goodness it was a good fit. You know, sometimes, you know, when you get into a situation, you know, a partnership with friends, sometimes, you know, things can get, you know, a little difficult and not exactly as expected. But I can tell you it's been terrific. Quentin's been an unbelievable partner, unbelievably supportive, and we work very synergistically together in the practice. And it was on all accounts the right move.
And that thing is great too. You can bring a huge clinical trial experience now to this new center in Florida.
That's true. Not only that, by the way, I have to say that where I am in Florida, which is in, you know, Southeast Florida, I'm in, you know, West Palm Beach, Boynton Beach, and so forth, I'm seeing all the same patients. They're all down here for the winter, so they all came down. I'm still seeing them, which is great. Yes, I mean it. So it worked out. It worked out really well.
I
And
think it's
yes, I mean, so
fantastic work.
you know, it was great. And so I'm working on getting the clinical research set up at this practice. It's a corporate-owned practice, so it's not exactly a situation where I can just go in and call the
Right.
shots and say, "Hey, here's how we're going to set it up." But I've given them the framework, and when they feel it is the right time for them, they'll invest in the infrastructure that's necessary. But for the moment, and I do miss it, I am not doing clinical research, which is a shame because I have, you know, a lot of expertise and a lot of experience under my belt with respect to that, in both pharma and device, mostly pharma, but device as well. And you know, I'm hopeful that we can get that going in the near future.
Yeah, you have a very good expertise. I mean, in excess of 100 clinical trials in the past. What's your advice? So, yeah, a lot of young ophthalmologists love this podcast and they want to get involved. How do they get started? What's step one to getting involved with clinical trials?
Well, so it's kind of interesting how it all happened for me, I can tell you. And there's lots of avenues, but for me, number one, getting involved with your industry partners is important. Because, you know, these trials ultimately, a lot of them come from industry, but also a lot of them come from small startups who don't necessarily know who you are. But the small startups often have consultants that talk to the bigger industry partners that are out there, and they're
Right.
like, "Hey, who's a good person to work with?" And so they'll get your name that way. But for me, the main trigger that got me started was reading, I believe it was Ocular Surgery News.
Sure.
Okay. And they have you know, the industry corner in there. And this goes back, this was 2003, by the
Okay.
way.
Oh,
That
okay.
was the year, 2003. And I'm reading, and you know, they say who's got, you know, a phase whatever trial or who just got approved or whatever is going on with respect to companies with products in development and on the research side. And I saw that a company known as Tsukempa Pharmaceuticals,
Okay.
the Japanese company, was doing a trial of FK506, which is tacrolimus for dry eye. And I looked at that and they said they were just starting and looking for sites. So I just cold contacted them and I wrote them a very nice email and I said, you know, this is who I am. I'm Jody Lux. I am working at this practice. I was the co-director of refractive surgery at the time for the health system on Long Island, and that I was a cornea fellow, you know, fellowship trained cornea specialist, and I'd be interested in participating in this clinical trial if you're looking for sites. You know, just sort of spitting in the wind, hoping maybe that they'd take notice. And lo and behold, they wrote me back.
Wow.
And they came in and they did a site visit, and we happened to have someone at my, and this is important, you need to have a research coordinator, clinical research coordinator, at your site. So you know, you need to have somebody who has that training. So when they came into this to my site to do a site visit, which is key, they saw that we had our ducks in the row, the appropriate equipment, the appropriate procedure manuals and so forth that my clinical research coordinator had put together. And you even had a little packet for them explaining everything. And so they saw that we're not just a guy who's interested in research who doesn't know what he's getting into. We had the infrastructure. And that's really important because they looked for that. Then they gave us the okay to participate in the clinical trial, which we did. Unfortunately, the trial ultimately didn't meet its endpoints, but that's neither here nor there. But the other thing is to be able to deliver. If they tell you that they're going to choose you and they are asking you how many patients do you think you can deliver over X period of time in this trial, you need to be able to deliver that, and you need to be able to deliver the patients with clean data. And once you do that, the CROs, the clinical research organizations that run these trials, they take notice and they say, "Aha, that's a site that they've got their ducks in the row. There's very little stuff we need to do on monitoring visits. They delivered their quota of patients, and the data they delivered was clean." So then they keep you in mind for the next trial, and then they
Right.
start calling. Okay. And then other clinical trials get clinical research organizations get wind of the information that you participated in this trial and you give good data, so they start calling you. And it sort of snowballs. And that's what really happened over a period of a number of years ramping up. And then I was just getting calls and emails all the time. We've got this study going on. Are you interested in participating? And ultimately we had two research coordinators and then an OD that we hired also to help us out seeing some of these patients. And we ramped up from there, and we even put it on the door that we had a research department. So it worked really well. And when I left the practice back in 2018, we left actually with 12 active clinical trials.
Wow.
So at the time, which is a lot. And I just sort of closed those out as after I left. But so it was a very busy time, and it's great. And patients love hearing that you're involved with clinical research. And they're always asking when they're in the lane, is there a clinical trial that,
Help. Yeah.
that I can help with that is applicable to what I've got. So it was a real practice builder as well for us.
Well, I think the important thing there is having that clinical coordinator in your practice who has to be exceedingly organized. Like, that's probably the most important
Exactly. Absolutely. And this clinical coordinator that we had originally, she was the clinical research coordinator from the big health system, and she moved out of the health system and joined us in our private practice as a lead tech. But when research came calling, she was already trained and ready to go, and just slipped into that role.
Right. And then
So
you have to
it
look
worked out.
at population too, because sometimes, depending on population, it can be hard to enroll patients. And you never want to sign up for a trial. Say you're going to deliver 50 patients and you just can't meet that.
Yeah, they're counting on you to deliver that or close to that quota,
Right.
or have a really good reason why you can't. Maybe the child's not enrollable because the criteria are not good, and that's on them. But when all the other sites are enrolling their quota and you're not, it doesn't look good.
Right. No, for sure. For sure. And then also having every patient come to every visit and have every bit of data, like you said, clean data, but no blank spots. You did all the things you
Exactly.
did every single visit. You have perfect data sets.
Yeah, and that's the idea. And the more you can do that where you don't have any protocol deviations, then obviously you rise to the top as one of the people they want, because they're not spending hours and hours deciphering your data and cleaning up your data, and potentially facing a situation where your data can confound the results of the trial. And those are the type of people they want in their trials. Saves them money, saves them time, and gives them clean results.
And then, of course, once you do really well with these trials, you get like a reputation of, oh yeah, listen, we got a trial coming up. You know what? Let's ask Jody. Jody will get the data. You get them enrolled, you get the clean data, it'll be great.
And not only that, then they'll start asking you, hey, can you suggest some other people
Right.
who also can be potential good investigators of the trial, who will deliver their quota and deliver clean data. So it becomes an internal referral network as well.
And also knowing your patients. Like, I actually do very, very few clinical trials because the Beverly Hills patients, they don't care what the incentive is. I don't want anything experimental on me. So it's like,
Yeah,
it's nearly impossible to
right.
enroll them.
And it can be difficult. And part of it is how you approach it with the patients.
Right.
So, for example, you tell the patients that you're going to be followed much closer than you would be if you weren't in the clinical trial, because we're going to have to see you every 3 days or whatever it is. We're going to give you either a very good treatment, or if you don't get the treatment, we're going to know pretty quickly. And if there's any problems, you can withdraw from the clinical trial at any time. We're not going to let anything happen to you. We're going to watch you very closely. You reassure the patients, and usually the patients that you're enrolling, a lot of them are patients that already know you for a number of years, and they know that you're going to do the right thing by them. And so we didn't find it a terribly hard sell to get patients to join clinical trials. But it certainly can be in certain instances.
So a great first step, let's say, for a young ophthalmologist in the community is to probably just talk with his industry contacts of the companies for the products he's already using, because all these companies then have things in the works.
Absolutely. You definitely get to know your industry contacts, get involved with them, be sure to spend time with the reps when they come into the office, make sure to spend time with the managers when you go to the conferences, try and meet the higher management. You know, let them know that you have, you're interested in clinical trials or anything you may have in development, that you have the appropriate resources, the patient base in your practice. And it's not necessarily going to come immediately, but so long as you keep, the networking and the contacts up, keep the conversation open, ultimately they may keep you in mind. If you end up doing any speaking for these companies, that also gets you more involved with the management of the companies, especially if you do a good job. And when you go to the speaker training and so forth, you meet some of the higher management. So again, just networking, getting your name known to the industry partners is a good way to start the conversation. Ultimately that can filter down to the research department when there is stuff going on. It doesn't happen overnight, but start laying the groundwork early. Ultimately in many cases it can pay off.
For sure. Now, when you work with all these trials, you must have gleaned some like extra insights. So I know you were very prolific in some of the initial trials for like cyclosporin or with a later form of it, fitagraft. What kind of pearl did you learn from this that the average guy like me may miss?
So, clinical trials are an interesting construct, really. You learn a lot about placebo effect.
Okay.
Because you really see it. In all the clinical trials I've done, I have to tell you that it's been very difficult to sort out in your mind. Remember, they're all blinded or, masked. So you don't know for sure who's getting what. In all clinical trials, I have to say there's really never been a situation where I could tell definitively you're getting the active, you're getting the placebo. So you get a very real respect for a placebo effect, because you see it in these patients. You also get a real respect for, looking out for any untoward effects, okay? Because the clinical trial forces you to look specifically for any adverse events, number one. Also, what's interesting is the clinical trial forces you to do things by the book. Right. So for example, so you have to put in the fluorescein, you have to wait 2 minutes for the fluorescein to develop. Well, they tell you that, when you're going through residency and fellowship, that it takes time for fluorescein to develop. But quite frankly, for example, when you go to if you pop in anyone's office who's examining patients, they're going to put in fluorescein, they're looking right away, right?
Yep, of course, that's what I do.
They're looking right away. So, but this forces you to do it by the book. So, of course, I look right away, but then, of course, you wait the 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes, whatever they say, and you'd be surprised how much develops after that period of time. It's just things about the academic way of doing things you get a little more respect for when you're doing these trials, because the trial forces you to do that. And it also gives you a, not that you didn't know it already, but a very real insight into the issue of compliance, because some of these trials are hard for patients to comply with. And they've got very specific rules and diaries that you got to fill out and so forth. And you get a real sense of what it takes to maintain compliance. And you got to keep calling them, you got to keep on top of them. They're still not doing it. So you get a real sense of what the difference really is between once a day, twice a day, three times a day, four times a day dosing of a medication in terms of compliance. And for those of us who take medication themselves, I can tell you that my cutoff is twice a day. If it's after twice a day, I can't keep up with it. Okay. And I'm a doctor and I know the issues, and I can just tell you, I can't do it. So you get a real sense and a real feeling for the real issues with compliance, and really why it's so important that we try to develop drugs that can be effective with reduced dosing schedules, once or twice a day tops.
Right. I think twice a day is probably the easy. Four times a day. You got to take the bottle with you to work.
You got to take it with you to work. You got to remember to do it. I forgot to do it. Do I take another one? You know, I don't know. And it gets real messy. And, you know, you get a real, you know, understanding of that when you're looking at the clinical trials and looking at compliance rates. So, you know, it just, I think being involved overall made me a little bit of a better and more understanding physician, because I know the consequences if things aren't quite done by the book, that you can miss things. I understand better the issues that patients have with compliance, and how that affects outcomes. You know, so, you know, and on the flip side, it's really cool to be involved with clinical trials and know that when you see all these drugs on the shelf, that you can say, well, I was involved with the approval of that one, that one, that one, and that one. It's pretty cool, you know, to ultimately have that, that, you know, that feeling that, yeah, I was involved with that. So it's, and when patients come and, you know, you're putting them on that medication, you can say, yeah, you know, I was actually involved with the development of that. And it's a great drug and, you know, worked really well in the clinical trials. You know, you know, from experience, you were there.
Right. Yeah. Like you were saying earlier, the protocol is like, yeah, just when you say we got to put the fluorescein, you got to wait 2 minutes, then you got to evaluate. I was in a trial where I had to check anterior chamber cell after surgery. We got to look at you got to count the cells for X amount of seconds. You have to look away, come back and do it again, and then take the average of the two.
Exactly. It's right. Yeah.
No one ever does that in practice.
What's that?
I said, no one ever does that in practice. You just look.
You take a look, you see what you see, and then you're done, right? But you're absolutely right, you know, because maybe there was a little cluster that went by, but really there's nothing significant happening. You know, and just a few cells floating by is considered normal in, you know, these clinical trials. So, you know, you need to see 2 to 5 cells, for example, before it hits the radar, you know, for high power field. So anyway, yeah, you get a real feel for that kind of a thing. Which is not necessarily something you appreciate in everyday clinical practice.
Right. And the trial I was involved with, it was an NSAID for post-op inflammation after cataract surgery. The amazing part was like, yes, with this NSAID alone, at let's say at the one-month mark, maybe like 70% of patients cleared all their cells. Even the placebo group who got nothing but saline drops, like 30% of them cleared after a month. Like,
yeah. And I was involved in a couple of those studies as well, which number one, gives you a couple of things. Number one, you get a sense that NSAIDs actually are pretty good at suppressing postoperative inflammation. That's number one. But, you know, number two is, even if we look at all these clinical trials for NSAIDs after postoperative inflammation, and you look at those placebo groups, you can get a real feel for the fact that there actually is a very significant rate of spontaneous clearing of postoperative inflammation without any medication. Now, we're not talking about risk of CME and all that stuff, but inflammation actually clears on its own in, you know, it's about 25 to 30% of patients without therapy. But again, they may be at greater risk for CME down the line, but yeah, it clears on its own. But obviously NSAIDs do very well, and NSAIDs plus steroids actually do the best.
Yeah, no, for sure. Now, you've had also, besides these trials, though, now you have a lot of other projects. You're involved with Stuart Therapeutics. Tell me about that. You're chief medical officer there.
Yep. So I'm chief medical officer, and I'm on the board of directors of Stuart Therapeutics. And Stuart has collagen mimetic peptide, or CMP, which repairs damaged collagen. So as such, it repairs the ocular surface and makes an excellent drug for dry eye. We've completed a phase 2 and a phase 3A clinical trial. We're about to launch a phase 3B clinical trial for dry eye. Very exciting. And what's nice about that drug is it repairs the surface. So it repairs the staining, which, of course, translates also to improved symptoms. It does it very quickly within just a couple of days. It really treats the final common pathway of dry eye. It doesn't really matter what the cause is, whether it's evaporative loss or aqueous deficiency or anything. It treats that final common pathway. So it's agnostic as to the cause. And so we're excited about that. It also has applicability for neuroprotection, which is licensed that technology to Glaukos, and potentially some posterior segment efficacy in therapeutic areas as well. So we're very excited about the drug and its couple of different verticals within eye care, and looking forward to that that phase 3b trial, which hopefully be launching very shortly, and that's the story. So very excited about that. I've been involved with them for over 4 years now, and you know, just very excited about where this drug is going.
It's interesting. Yeah, you're using it not only because, but also some neuroprotective, some patch for glaucoma.
That's correct. Yeah. So it's by repairing the collagen matrix and the intracellular matrix and the supporting collagen network around the nerve fibers, it allows the nerves to potentially regenerate. It also potentially protects the nerves from damage. And we have some excellent data, preclinical data to support that. And Glaukos actually found that very compelling and licensed the technology, which they are now continuing to develop. So very excited about that as well. I think, like I said, there's a number of different therapeutic areas that this drug has applicability to, and we're very excited about the future growth of this company.
Right. Wow. You're also involved in entrepreneur efforts in doctor formulated supplements. Tell us about that. And what have you chosen to kind of put in those supplements?
Yes. So what I did, and this is going back kind of to a little bit of a past life. You really dug up everything, didn't you?
homework.
Yeah. So I developed back in, started this company back in year 2000. I noticed an unmet need, which is that a lot of patients that require the AREDS vitamins,
Sure.
you know, for macular degeneration. If you've ever seen those pills, you know, they're big. They're horse pills.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of patients can't swallow those pills. So I said, well, you know, this was the age where functional beverages were really starting to take off in the market. So I said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could make a functional beverage for eye health that contain the AREDS vitamins? I wasn't looking to reinvent the wheel. We know the AREDS formula has tried and true science behind it, with the AREDS 1 at the time and now the AREDS 2 studies. And so I said, let's see if we can make a functional beverage. And again, my beautiful wife, I'm like, I'm going to try that. She's like, you never want to look back and say, I should have.
Right.
She's like, let's, you know, because it would take some investment. She's like, you know, when someone else does it, you don't want to say, I should have done that. So she's like, let's go for it. So I did a little research. I found a company that puts together formulations. And I said, I want to take this, you know, formulation, and I want to make it into a functional beverage. I want it to be all natural. I want it to be healthy. I want it to be, you know, to contain, you know, fruit juice. But I don't want it to be a big thing. Not a lot of calories. So we came up with a beverage, which we called, and I brought in a marketing person to help me develop the marketing materials and the name. We called it OJO, OJO, which of course is Spanish for eye, OJO Fortified Eye Care Network, Nectar. And it had it was an 8-ounce bottle, 50% fruit juice. We had three flavors, and it contained the AREDS vitamins. And just a couple of other, in addition, a couple of other antioxidant fruits, basically, you know, blackberry, bilberry, you know, things like that. It was an 8-ounce beverage, and we had three flavors, and, you know, it tasted great, which was hard to do, by the way, with those vitamins.
So, flavors taste terrible.
Right. I mean, they do. So that took a little finagling with the flavor house. And we got it, and I produced it, and then I went about trying to sell it. And we had a few different service lines, and I brought in some consultants to help me figure that out. We had, you know, we sold it through doctor's offices, but also I went about getting distributors. We actually took it to a natural products competition, and we won. We actually won the competition, which was great. Gave us a $5,000 check, which was nice to have. And over the years, we built it, and we had some sales, and we had some distributors on board. But it became costly because it was heavy. Drinks are heavy. And then there was a problem as to where on the shelf it was going to be. Was it going to be in the cold box and so forth? I don't want to bore you with the details. But it came to a point where we decided that it wasn't cost effective to continue it as in a beverage form. So we switched it to a stick pack powder.
Okay, interesting.
Okay, so this way we could package it in a box of 30. So you had a 1 month supply in a box. We called it Ojo Fortified Eye Care Crystals. So Ojo Crystals. And we had three flavors, box of 30, one little stick pack. You could take it anywhere. You tear it open. You could dissolve it in anything. You could put it in your bottle of water. You could put it in fruit juice. You could put it in yogurt. You could put it in whatever you want. And then you could have it once a day, full Arrowheads complement. And that actually did a lot better. It was cheaper to produce, took up less shelf space. Everybody knew where to do it. And we grew it over the years such that we ultimately got it to 4,000 GNC stores. So we're on the shelf at GNC 4,000 stores, and and I'm doing this kind of by myself with my my co-founder, who is the marketing person, and mostly bootstrapping it myself. I had some outside investment, but not a lot, and we got it up to that point, and which was great. And I figured I'd be off to the races if I can get on GNC. But what I learned was that two things, and you learn about business, not having a business background, and you learn a couple of things. Number one is that what GNC cares about is real estate. This thing took up about that much shelf space, okay, compared to a bottle of pills, bottle of vitamins. Okay. Yeah. So it's the number of turns per surface area, number of turnovers that they can get within a certain amount of time. So I was selling, but I wasn't selling well enough to make it worthwhile for them to keep it on the shelf. And I didn't have enough investment to enough capital to invest in it to produce the promotion I needed to potentially bring it up to that level. And I didn't have a full-time CEO, which I should have had, to be able to take it to the next level and to go out there and solicit the appropriate investment to get me to the next level. So when I moved to Florida, I had to shelve the business. So unfortunately, it's not active anymore. We had trademarks all across. It was a beautiful eye chart design for the front of it. We had trademarks with a whole bunch of stuff on that. If anyone out there wants it, I'd be happy to talk.
I just love it. The learning experience, the whole process of doing this, it's the whole pursuit.
Yes. And so it was a 10-year process.
Sure.
A lot of investment along the line. I learned a lot. I think I got pretty far as a guy who has another day job, running this thing. We got a bunch of different national distributors, and we got the shelf at GNC and a lot of smaller market chains, but just wasn't enough without the investment to take me to the next level and a full-time CEO that could dedicate the time. So, like I said, I had to shelve it. But if anyone wants to revive it, I'd be happy to talk with them.
I think it's a cool idea. That's really, Thanks.
Thank you.
And now you're also involved with VC, venture capital. Tell me about that. Yes.
So I am the chief science officer for InFocus Capital Partners, which is a venture capital firm which invests in ophthalmic life sciences. So we've invested in 13 portfolio companies in our first fund that have very exciting technology and development, mostly pharma, but some device in the ophthalmic space. Most of those companies are doing very well. One of them is Stewart Therapeutics.
Sure.
We are actively now looking to open fund two, our second fund. We're soliciting investment in that fund, And once we have collected the appropriate funds, then we will start investing in companies to round out our Fund 2 portfolio. So very exciting. A number of companies like Stewart in our portfolio are, and we invested, by the way, in early stage companies, so seed or early A investment, and in companies that had promising technology that was as de-risked as you can be at that stage.
Sure.
And one of them has a company has exited, which was Cellview, which was purchased by Essilor. And Cellview was an imaging technology to rival OCT imaging. As I said, Essilor purchased that technology just within the last year. And we have a number of other portfolio companies that are doing very well with their clinical trials and hopefully getting ready to do some sort of exit in the near future.
Well, I think it's great to be such a focused fund. Pardon the pun there, because you're investing in ophthalmology. It's like, that's what we know. That's what we can understand.
Exactly. And we have them in the ability to invest 10% of our funds into non-ophthalmic life sciences. But in Fund 1, it was primarily, it was all life ophthalmic life sciences. But like you said, what we know best, our advisors are all, ophthalmologists, although we have one who's a physician, but not an ophthalmologist. Our expertise is within ophthalmology. So you want to go deep and narrow, right? So you want to, right? You want to invest deeply in the narrow field that you know best, and work from there.
Right. I mean, we're all MDs, but don't ask me to evaluate a company that makes orthopedic devices or urology. I don't know anything.
Right, exactly. We might be able to get the basics, but we're really not going to know deeply how that affects the market in urology, for example, or whatever. And we're not going to necessarily know it well enough to know whether or not it's going to be something disruptive in that space that will have traction in the market if it makes it that far.
Yeah, I think that's great advice for a lot of things. Be very narrow in your focus, but very deep in your knowledge.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Whatever you're doing in business, right? You don't want to be all over the place. You want to do one or two things and you want to do them really well. And if you do that, then you're going to be successful with that. And then you can go on and do the next thing or the next thing. But it's hard to do three, four, five things at once.
Right. Even in your practice, like my practice, only cataract and refractive surgery. It's really focused.
Right. Neuro into.
Right. So much so that when I see some retina white dot syndrome, I'm just thinking like, wait a minute, what is this? I have no idea.
Right. It might be interesting for you to think about it. Well, maybe it's mutes, maybe it's this or whatever, right? But I'm going to send it to somebody who really knows what they're doing and let's get a real diagnosis.
Right. Some of my other physician friends who are not ophthalmologists, they're in disbelief that, what do you mean you don't do the whole eye? They're like, it's two things the size of walnuts. How come you can't do the whole eye? So I'm like, you'd be surprised. It's more complex than you think.
Very complex organ.
Right. Now, tell me how the patients, so you're saying the patients are basically the same patients in Florida as you have in New York, right? You do the surgery in Florida in January. If you're in New York, you do it in like July.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm still very in touch with and very close with my partners, my ex-partners back in New York. So we have a very good relationship, and they'll tell patients that, you do your surgery with me, or next month you're heading down to Florida, good luck to your surgery down there. I'll see you when you get back, and vice versa. So it's a great relationship. They still give out my cards, for patients who are coming down. So it's a nice symbiotic relationship. I think it's good that we left on good terms, it didn't have to go that way. Right. When you think about, when you part with a practice, you're leaving them in a lurch. You've been there with them for 20 plus years, and of course I gave them plenty of notice, but still, it feels like, you're stabbing them in the back kind of thing, and it was nothing to do with them. It was a life choice for me. And then, of course, whenever you're leaving, you know, there could always be issues with, you know, the buyout and money and things like that that can complicate the relationship or sour the relationship afterwards. And thank goodness, you know, and we had a few, you know, differences of opinion, we'll say, with respect to the buyout and things like that. But, you know, we have civil conversations and we work through all of that. And, you know, and we moved on. And I still visit them when I go up there, you know, so, and that helps. So we have a nice relationship. I see all the patients, even some of the ones that I kind of ran away from. They find me, and it's very nice, and it kind of keeps things full circle.
Well, I think that's a great pro too, is that when you do, you know, almost all of us are going to end up having a career pivot or change in practice, is to just don't sweat the small stuff, and it's almost all small stuff, and try to look at amicable terms.
Exactly, exactly. And if you're going to make a move like this, obviously you got to do your due diligence and make sure that, you know, it's a viable move. And, you know, if you have that, then it's just a matter of, do you feel comfortable pulling the trigger? And that's what it came down to. And because I'm more of a conservative guy, I'm like, I got a good thing going here. Yeah, okay. It's not necessarily how I want my career to finish out, but it's a good thing. What if, you know, what if I'm wrong? You know, and if it's not good, but at some point you've got to, you know, make a decision and pull a trigger one way or the other. So I did. And like I said, I couldn't have done it without my wife saying, if you're going to do it,
now's
the time. And I'm behind you if that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
So I did. Look at that.
And I also learned the hard way that the best business decisions are where both parties say, all right, I guess it's good enough. Exactly. One party's not thrilled and the other party's sad. No, both parties are like, okay, fine.
Right. No one's, if one person's thrilled, then chances are the other one's a little sad and may not be inequitable, right? You know, so right. It's kind of like my divorce. Both parties are not exactly as happy. It's probably an equitable settlement. So, you know, same idea.
Right. And then that's so smart too. I've obviously changed gears many times in my career. And look at the Cattle Coach stuff, total reinvention, you know, 8 years ago.
Right. And by the way, I think it needs to be said, I'm sure you hear it all the time, hats off to you for what you have created with CataractCoach.com. I mean, I've been a fan for, I don't even know how many years now. I'm lurking in the background and watching all of those videos and listening to what you have to say. And, I think you created an invaluable resource for everybody to be able to show, look at Afghan, quite frankly, you're at the top of this field. When people think about cataract and refractive surgery, they're thinking about you, and be able for you to have this forum out there to teach people, even seasoned professionals.
Right.
I still learn, you know, something, you know, I'm not on your level, but I'm learning things all the time when I watch your videos. And I think that's an important point. You are never at any point in your career too learned, if you will, too experienced to pick up something new.
Of course. Okay? Yeah.
I mean, you've done tens of thousands of cataracts. I've done thousands of cataracts, maybe tens of thousands of cataracts. And I still, every now and then, I'm doing a cataract and I'm like, yeah, I've never seen that before. Or you know what? There's a different way of doing this that I just did, like by accident. You know what? That's a great little nuance. You still pick stuff up even thousands and thousands of cases in. So you're never too old to learn something new. You're never too experienced. And you point that out very eloquently on your cataractcoach.com. So my hat's off to you for what you've created. It's a valuable resource. And thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. We all learn together. It's like I get 60 cataract videos submitted to me a week. I go through all of them and I choose the best 10% to feature every week.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's wonderful. And you know, you point stuff out that, you know what, some people say, well, that's obvious. And then you point something out about that that's not that obvious. And it's like, wow. You know, and then next week you're in the operating room and you see that.
I just did a case this week on Monday of a patient, my first time ever doing cataract surgery in a woman with pretty dense corneal granular dystrophy.
Yeah.
She's won the cataract done. She's been seeing through this granular dystrophy her whole life. She's used to it. She probably has some underlying amblyopia. And
yeah,
that was a heck of a challenge.
Oh, Because you're getting the glare from all of those when you're shining that light, looking in, and your view's terrible. They've got a nice pinhole view out through those things.
Right.
Those granules, they give them a pinhole effect. But when you're got the oblique lighting and the coaxial lighting you're trying to see in there, then the view is miserable. I've been there. You know, it's terrible. But so it makes it challenging. And, you know, you earn a new respect, right?
Right.
For cataract surgery when you're doing that. So, you know, every time I do that small pupil, floppy iris, deep set eye, doesn't dilate, loose zonules, I'm like, oh my God. And it's like every time you do one, they're all different. You earn a new respect for the eye in those situations. And, you know, and yeah, and then you change your shorts.
Well, I think all of us. I think the more you know, the more cases you do, the more you realize that, you know what, we don't know everything.
Right. And every eye is different. So, which is, again, why there's such a need for what you do with cataractcoach.com. It's just keeping the education going, teaching us all, you know, about this wonderful field that we're in with cataract surgery.
Yeah. Now we even have a retina sister channel, retinarounds.com.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I have a retina colleague who does those videos and those podcasts. And I, you know, it's one of my guilty pleasures. I watch every one of those. It's just, they're really cool. And it's like, there's so much I just didn't understand about the retina until watching these videos.
Yeah, sure. And that's great. I mean, it's just wonderful that these things are popping up. And who runs that primarily, if I may ask?
That's Pradeep Prasad. He's an ophthalmologist in Los Angeles. He was faculty at UCLA for many years. Now he does private practice in Beverly Hills. But just fantastic discussion of these cases. And all these pearls. Now, I don't ever want to do retina surgery, but I find it very interesting. I'm happier for them all. He can handle all of it. I don't want the grief.
Yeah, if you're doing retina surgery, something's gone very wrong.
You know, I don't want to be doing that. But I think it's also, this is kind of a new way of learning. I think ophthalmology may be a little bit behind. Like, for example, 15 years ago, I would get car magazines every month in my house, like actual magazines, Road and Track and Car and Driver and Automobile magazines. I get none, and I don't go. All I do now is I watch YouTube videos.
Yeah,
and I think
that's a different world.
But that's how ophthalmology is going now. The number of views is off the charts. It's millions of views I get per month.
Yeah, you know what else is important about that? And by the way, that's great. It shows you how everything transformed. But so you know, when I was a resident back in the Stone Age, you know, phaco was not mainstream,
right?
On Long Island at the time. So I did 100 about thereabouts extra caps when I was a resident, and 12 phacos.
Wow.
Okay. And then I went and did a cornea fellowship at Wills, where we did 0 cataracts. Okay. So everything I learned essentially about doing modern cataract surgery, phaco, was self-taught over the years. Okay, and this starts beyond, you know, before we had YouTube and Cataract Coach and things like that. So, you know, you learn by experience. And now having these tools available, okay, because our younger ophthalmologists that are out there now, you know, in 25 years, cataract surgery may look very different. Right. So they're going to, just like, you know, cataract surgery today is different than when I started practice. They're going to need to learn how to evolve with the times, to evolve their surgical technique to whatever's coming down the line. Right. So having these resources available to help show them how it's done for people that are doing it or pioneering, learning the technology, whatever technology comes down the line, that's just such an invaluable resource, you know, for everybody. So having these things is great. And, you know, that's one of the pluses of the, you know, electronic age that we're in. And now, of course, AI helping us out with all that stuff. So
it's a new world, for sure.
It's a new world, right?
Well, fantastic. Well, Jody, we can talk for an hour. Can you believe it? What a fun conversation.
That is it is an hour. Wow.
Well, I want to thank you for doing this podcast. Such great insight about the clinical trials, about your practice pivoting. You had some beautiful pearls. I think the young ophthalmologists in particular will find this one very helpful.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm honored to be here again. I thank you for the opportunity. Of course, anytime if you want to talk again, I'm available.
Oh, sounds great. Remind our listeners and viewers, remember, get a new Counter Coach podcast every Sunday. Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find a podcast, you find the Counter Coach podcast. And of course, we have a new Counter Coach video every single day. So until next time, I catch you later.